Have you planned your vacation yet? You've a choice between sand and sunburn, or mountain climbing and the Charlie horse. I find it all very enervating, but we should all have some kind of holiday. So, my suggestion is a quiet little tour, say about 2,000 miles. I have just made a motion picture, North by Northwest, to show you some of these delights. And the ideal place to start our holiday fun trip is New York, where Cary Grant can go places and do things. You don't find a tasteful little murder on every guided tour, now do you? But this means we must leave Manhattan.
Hello there.
Tell me, why are you so good to me?
Shall I climb up and tell you why? How do I know you aren't a murderer?
You don't.
A train may be an old-fashioned way to travel, but an upper berth can be a lovely place to go when it's your time to go. After an uneventful fine night's rest, we arrive in Chicago. We seek out culture in a great art gallery. We can't leave Chicago without a visit to the Great Plain. The people are also friendly in the great outdoors. And now for the climax of our tour, the inspiration of a great American monument, the serene nobility of Mount Rushmore. On this tour, you are sure of charming companions, like Cary Grant, entirely relaxed, and a bit on the reticent side.
I'm an advertising man, not a red herring. I've got a job, a secretary, a mother, two ex-wives, and several bartenders dependent upon me. And I don't intend to disappoint them all by getting myself slightly killed.
And for vacation romance, how about an amorous blonde like Eva Marie Saint? She's the kind of girl that gets into a man's blood, even if she has to shoot her way in. Now for the best news of all. You can enjoy this wonderful vacation while seated comfortably in this theater. I promise you nothing but entertainment. A vacation from all your problems, as it was for me.
Welcome to another episode of the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this week to talk about the classic, Alfred Hitchcock's 1959 film North by Northwest, starring Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint, is a longtime friend of the show and one of the lecturers of the Department of Popular Culture American Culture Studies program at Bowling Green State University, Chuck Coletta. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Rob. It's very nice to talk to you. I've been a long-time listener, followed all your shows and everybody else on the network. You guys are doing a wonderful job.
Thank you very much. I didn't make Chuck say that to get on the show, everybody. he said that of his own volition. Now, this is really cool. You said you've been commenting and leaving great YouTube videos on our shows for a long time, and this is really cool to finally have you on. And I need to thank you on air for something, but we'll get to that later on in the show. But yeah, we're here to talk about North by Northwest. Of course, this is Alfred Hitchcock's 1959 film, one of his most famous films, of course, featuring one of the most iconic shots in all of cinema, right. And we'll get to that too. Basically, for anyone who hasn't seen it, the plot is very briefly described as thus: a hapless New York advertising executive, which is Cary Grant, is mistaken for a government agent by a group of foreign spies and is pursued across the country while he looks for a way to survive. And it's on the way that he runs into a mysterious woman played by Eva Marie Saint. And one of the people pursuing him is James Mason and his henchman played by the great Martin Landau. So, Chuck, first of all, what's your history with this movie? Why did you want to talk about it? And why do you think this film in particular, out of all of Hitchcock's films, really has sort of stood the test of time?
Well, number one, I don't even remember the first time I saw North by Northwest. I've seen most of Hitchcock's movies, not all of them. But I think this really is sort of the ultimate Hitchcock movie. It has all the elements of what you expect in a classic Hitchcock movie. The icy blonde, the scenes set at national monuments. He's had movies in the past where they took place at the Statue of Liberty or the Golden Gate Bridge, and here it's Mount Rushmore. But I think it's sort of a good, up until 1959, it really encapsulates everything that he was doing. And I think it's probably one of his last great movies. And now Psycho was the one that followed this. The 60s are kind of hit and miss for a lot of Hitchcock's work, but I think if you want to start seeing a Hitchcock, it's sort of the breeziest, most enjoyable, kind of a romp. You don't have to worry about the plot too much, and you're not really worried for Cary Grant. You're concerned about him, but you know in the end everything's going to be okay. So it's not really a horror movie, but it's just sort of a fun 2.5 hours at the movies.
Yeah, it has a real light touch. I mean, it's certainly Cary Grant's character is sort of interesting here. Well, not sort of interesting. It is interesting. His name is Roger O. Thornhill. Here he's again, he's advertising executive, and we're introduced to him, and he's giving a dictation to his secretary, who follows him in a cab. And then he ends up sending her back to the original location of the office because he's so busy that he doesn't even have time to relay everything in the office. She's got to follow him around. But it's funny because Cary Grant, of course, had worked with Hitchcock several times before, but here he's really, I would say, sending up his own image a bit because he's a very henpecked guy. I mean, he talks about the theater tickets for his mother, and then later on he meets his mother, and he's sort of kind of like a little bit of a kind of like a mama's boy, which is amazing, right? Considering you've got Cary Grant, one of the most, biggest heartthrobs in all of the movies, playing this kind of guy. And I have to figure that Grant was completely in on the joke.
Yeah, and really this is one of the last times he played a romantic lead. I mean, he retired by 66, which wasn't, he was only 55 when he made the movie, but it really is like a classic leading man, Hollywood star performance. I mean, this is what it is to be a movie star in the 20th century. He was, desirable to women. He was he wasn't threatening to men. People wanted to be like him. I mean, nobody looked better in a tuxedo and that suit that he wears. I was doing a little research. There have been short stories written about that suit and people analyzing literally every thread of that suit. He just is sort of he seems effortless at what he's doing, but there's obviously a lot of work that he's crafted this persona that you don't really have to know anything about Roger Thornhill. He just bursts in off of that elevator in the first scene, and he's Cary Grant, and there he is, and we're gonna watch him be put through his paces for the next couple of hours.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really beautiful film to look at. I mean, it opens, of course, with the great credits by Saul Bass. I love Saul Bass's stuff, but I mean, this is a particularly nice, I love all the right angles of everything, of the lettering just off the side. And then you see, of course, it's the face of the skyscraper, but I find it's interesting to say when Roger Thornhill is grabbed by these two goons and taken to the house of this Long Island estate of Lester Townsend, he's interrogated by this guy, Philip Van Damme, who is James Mason, and James Mason's henchman, as I said, Martin Landau, played by Leonard. And they keep insisting that he is this guy, this George Kaplan. And Roger Thornhill's like, no, I'm not this guy. And they just won't give up on it. And it's interesting to watch, again, someone so manly and seemingly so in charge of everything to be – they just won't listen. I mean, they just refuse. He's like, I'm not George Kaplan. That's my terrible Cary Grant impression.
But that's right, because I think that's the theme that if you look through a lot of Hitchcock's movies, it's the wrong man, people who are wrongly accused of something. If you look at things like Notorious or Saboteur or Foreign Correspondent from the 40s, that at the beginning of the film, Cary Grant has everything. He's sort of the man in the kind of gray flannel suit walking through New York in that madman era. And then just by a tricky quirk of fate, your whole life can be upended, and you're on the run from the cops and the spies, and you never know what's around the corner. And I like that you said that they don't believe him. Nobody in the movie is actually pretending. They're all pretending to be somebody else at various times, or their identity is always shifting. James Mason isn't Lester Townsend at first.
Right, yeah.
We find out Eva Marie Saint is not who she appears to be. Everybody is sort of shifting. We find out that Martin Landau's character isn't exactly what we expect at the end of the movie. So everybody is a little bit dodgy and a little bit shady and not really on the up and up. They're all playing at each other with different angles.
Yeah, after he tries to escape, of course, he tries to get out of there, and they won't listen to him, and they won't let him go. They try and frame him by staging a drunk driving accident, which is a really great scene. Some wonderful rear projection of him driving down this road. And it's funny, it takes place in the town of Glen Cove, which I have happened to been to. I've been to there once. I actually, you're a lecturer. I did a lecture once for high school students about being an artist. Oddly enough. So it was funny when I saw the Glen Cove on the side of the police car. I was like, oh, I've been there. I've been in Glen Cove. I have to mention, too, one of the cops that comes to investigate this whole thing is played by the great character actor Edward Binns.
Right.
Who was in 12 Angry Men and The Verdict. I love him. He's got a tiny part, but I'm just so happy to see him in a movie. He's such a great actor.
Right. You know, and the film is filled with but there are several people who pop up in very small parts that are, you know, comic book readers or pop culture people would recognize. At the auction, the auctioneer is played by Les Tremaine, who was the mentor in the Shazam show. And his assistant is Olan Soule. I'm not sure how you say his name, but he was Batman on Super Friends. The other one that I'm originally from Cleveland. One of the cops who helps Cary Grant at the police station when he's calling his mother, his name is escaping me at the moment. But he was on the Cleveland Indians in 1948 when they last won a pennant, and was on General Hospital for like 25 or 30 years. So there's lots of little people in there who sort of like they just are in there for a couple of minutes, but they do their thing and they go. They're everybody's at the top of their game.
It's funny you mentioned that. We're kind of jumping around a bit, but I'll forget this if I don't mention it now. The guy with the scene where Thornhill ends up taking the bus and ends up in the middle of nowhere, which of course leads to the famous crop dusting scene. He ends up face to face with this other guy. And there's this wonderfully funny shot where it's all of a sudden Hitchcock pans wide and you just see the two of them staring at each other. I mean, there's nobody to be seen for 200 miles in any direction. And then these two guys are both pretending that they're not there to talk to one another because they're just staring at each other. And that guy, the guy who eventually gets on the bus and has the conversation with Thornhill, he is a guy – I spotted him in a movie called High School Big Shot, which was done on Mystery Science Theater 3000. And it's a really cruddy, cheap-looking movie. And he did it the same year as North by Northwest. And
wow.
I was like, what was this guy's agent like that he could get him this gig in High School Big Shot? And then he's in a Hitchcock movie. Like, what a weird career that guy had. You know, I was like, I'm so happy to recognize him.
There is one other person, and I didn't realize this until just when I was knew I was going to talk to you, so I looked a couple things up. But the real Townsend, who gets murdered at the UN, that was a character actor named Philip Ober, who he pops up in From Here to Eternity. But famously, or infamously, I guess it was, he was married to Vivian Vance, Ethel Mertz, at the time.
Geez.
That's what happens. Like, you know, those character actors, they can go in and do their thing and move on, and sometimes you get A quality work, and sometimes you have to do Mystery Science Theater level stuff.
You got to pay the bills. That scene in the UN building, of course, this was, you know, Hitchcock could not get permission to shoot inside the building, so apparently he stole a shot where he just sent Cary Grant up the steps and shot it from across the street. And apparently, if you look closely enough, you will see a guy who is not an extra. He is just a random guy, and he spots Cary Grant. And he does, like, a double take because he's like, oh, my God, that's Cary Grant. And luckily, you know, he didn't ruin the shot, but you can see him. It doesn't take you out of the movie because it doesn't ruin it. The guy, you know, you could just see just looking at something else. But when you know to look for it, it's funny to see the guy just do like a – and you know he went home to his wife that night. He's like, I saw Cary Grant in the steps of the UN.
That's right.
You know?
And then sure you did, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that scene in the UN building is great because he goes and he meets the real Townsend, the real right. Philip Townsend, and he's trying to figure out this guy, what's going on, and then he gets knifed in the back by one of the assassins, and of course, unfortunately, Cary Grant's character Thornhill does the one thing you shouldn't do,
no,
which is grab the knife out of the guy's back and get your fingerprints all over it.
That's right. You know, and I've seen this film a couple of times with audiences. I've shown it in class when I've taught a film class, and that always gets a laugh because it's a tense scene. But you know, he has his hand on the knife, and there's the person right there to take his picture, and it's, well, you can't help just but laugh at it. This film has a nice mix of drama and a lot of comedy. It shows you what Cary Grant could do. He could be funny, and he could be witty and charming, and he also could be a good dramatic actor when he needed to be.
I could be maybe thinking a little too much about this because I actually, as much as I think this is a classic, and I don't need to think it's a classic. It is a classic, but I think this film is probably not quite as deep as some of his other films. I think it seems a lot more surface. It seems Hitchcock just sort of having fun, especially with the final shot, which we'll mention. But one of the things that did occur to me in that scene specifically that you mentioned about when he grabs the knife and there's somebody there right at that moment. There's this repeated theme you mentioned about, of course, identity, is that you know, no one here is who they say they are. Everybody, even Marie Saint, James Mason, everybody here is somebody else. But Cary Grant is constantly on the wrong side of a situation in the middle of a crowd. He is always being – and, you know, I try to think about, could you remake this movie – not that you should, but, like, could you remake it today, or does it – only work in the time that it was made? And I think about, like, I feel like that there's the subtext of this is that the crowd is always wrong. They're always turning on our hero. We know the truth. Right. We know that Thornhill is innocent, but he is always being turned on by whatever crowd he's in. Now, they can't help it because they see a guy with a knife, you know, a guy with a stab wound, and there's Cary Grant holding the knife. But I almost feel like if you made it today, it would almost be involved with social media about the way you can – the mob can turn on you in an instant. You tweet the wrong thing and boom, you know, like your life could be over instantly.
Oh, yeah.
And that seems almost to be what's happening to Cary Grant here in 1957 parlance.
Yeah, you know, and I don't know – I was thinking of that too a little bit. I don't know who was sort of the modern equivalent of Cary Grant. I mean, you know, maybe Hugh Jackman, because I know he's popular with guys and girls, but I don't know if there's anybody who could sort of pull that off. And I think you're exactly right about it not having a lot of deep meaning, because I think that's what Hitchcock was interested in. He was interested in the style every detail was planned out on what the people were wearing and their costumes and even Marie Saint's jewelry and her hair and Cary Grant's suit. But he really didn't give any thought to, well, what really is going on? You don't really know what James Mason is up to. You don't really know exactly what – you see him sort of in a picture there in an old black and white photo. But there's not – it's just to be enjoyed. It's almost like – the closest thing that I can think of is that this film is kind of – a precursor to the James Bond movies,
mm-hmm.
that you don't have to worry about the plot too much. It's all going to turn out well, but here we are from one exciting set piece to another, and enjoy yourself, and everybody looks great, and that's the closest thing that I can think of to what – because Cary Grant was supposedly thought of as a early candidate for James Bond, but he pulled out. He thought he was too old for that kind of role. And he was only 55, you know, which is not that old, I guess.
Yeah, he seemed pretty sensitive to being too old for things because he turned down Roman Holiday because he thought he was too old for Audrey Hepburn. Of course, he ends up romancing her a couple years later in Charade. But you know, it's funny. I would say if there's an actor that I would compare as close to Cary Grant today, I would say it would have to be George Clooney.
Oh, you know, that's true. That's
Clooney,
true.
Clooney has certainly the looks. And I also think Clooney is a willing participant in subverting his own image, especially when he works with the Coen brothers. He seems to take delight in kind of crapping on his, you know, leading man persona. So I could sort of see Clooney doing this, although I don't know if I could picture Clooney as henpecked by his mother.
Yeah.
Cary Grant
I think you're right. But you know, when you look like somebody like Cary Grant or Joseph, when you look that good and you've got everybody falling all over yourself, must be difficult to be self-deprecating. You have to have, you know, have to be confident enough of yourself that you can be a fool, and he could, you know, he had that background in the circus, so he could do the stunts and fall on his face when he needed to. But it takes a certain kind of person to do it. The supposedly Jimmy Stewart was the original candidate for the role.
Right, because they just done Vertigo together.
They had just done Vertigo, and he and Hitchcock was originally working on a film called The Wreck of the Mary Deer, which turned out to be a movie about a sort of a courtroom drama about
Gary,
a ship.
Gary Cooper,
and it just wasn't going anywhere. And so he sort of came to do North by Northwest, and Jimmy Stewart was sort of in contention for that. And from what I've heard is that when he told him at the end, no, we're going to go with Cary Grant, that it sort of cooled their relationship for a while, because Jimmy Stewart was the everyman, and Cary Grant, no, he's not an everyman. He's sort of the idealized man that we wish we were.
Speaking of idealized, Thornhill ends up making it onto a train, and I'm a sucker for any movies featuring old trains, because who doesn't like looking at those? And that's where he meets Eve Kendall, played by Eva Marie Saint, who, you know, if you had someone who was sort of the physical equivalent of Cary Grant, a female version of Cary Grant in terms of impossibly beautiful,
right,
you would have to be Eva Marie Saint. And, of course, she is a sort of classic Hitchcock blonde. She's icy. She's clearly not saying everything that she knows. And, you know, it's kind of remarkable for a 1957 movie. She's pretty saucy. I mean,
that's right.
She's pretty open about the fact that she wants to bed Thornhill down and isn't really, except for one line that's dubbed over where apparently
right.
she said, I don't make love on an empty stomach, and they dubbed it to, I don't discuss love on an empty
that's
stomach,
right.
which you can sort of see. It was kind of clumsily dubbed. She is ridiculously beautiful in this movie.
Right. You know, and I don't think you get a better sort of like seduction. She's seducing him. In that scene, because she is sort of, you know, she's tipped the waiter to get him to come and sit next to her, and when we watch the movie, we find out who she really is and what's going on. But, you know, she takes his hand and blows out the match, and the way they're talking about Brook Trout, and I mean it's sort of innocuous, but it's very seductive. They don't make dialogue like that anymore, I don't think.
No, yeah. It's she's terrific in it. I mean, she's just terrific. Do you have any idea why? I should mention here that Chuck knows Miss Saint, and they are friends. And again, we'll get into that a little bit later. But do you have any idea why she never did another film with Hitchcock? You would think that it would be a perfect fit.
Well, from what I read, I don't know exactly why she never did another movie, but he had considered her supposedly when they were toying around a movie called Torn Curtain.
Oh, right.
But the studio insisted that Julie Andrews, who was really big and just won an Oscar at the time, that they wanted her in that. But I don't know why they never did it. I do know that she always. To this day is very admiring of him, and she's very positive towards him, and she doesn't want to hear when other actresses say that he was sort of this sadistic, toying with women sometimes. But as she said to me, it was a great experience. It was a great job. She was glad to be in it, but she had never thought, well, this is going to be a classic, or it was just
sure.
another wonderful experience. And, you know, sometimes you work with great people, and sometimes, you know, you only have that one opportunity to do so.
What did she say about working with Cary Grant?
Well, you know, she has talked about the two questions that she's asked most to this very day are, what was Marlon Brando like?
Right,
on the waterfront, and what was it like to kiss Cary Grant? and she says that he was very nice. He was somewhat aloof. He was a very nice person, a very warm person. He was very considerate of her. When he had it in his contract, supposedly, that the lighting on him had to be a certain wattage. If you notice in the film, he's got a deep tan, and he had to have a lot of light on him to sort of make him pop. And she's very fair skinned, and he graciously allowed the lights to be dimmed or moved so she would stand out a little bit better. There's an interesting story that I've heard her tell a couple of times that She went to some event with him. I think this may have been years later. They were making some sort of appearance, or they were together somewhere. And they walked into this theater filled with people, and everyone's eyes turned towards them. And after it was all over, she had said, "Well, how, you know, I find this a little bit disconcerting. I know I'm, you know, they're stars and they know that they're being seen, but, you know, how do you deal with this? Because you're such a superstar." And he told her is that, well, that's what he liked. He knew that people would go home the next day and they would tell their friends that they saw Cary Grant, and that that made them feel better, and that made him feel better. And he sort of became Cary Grant. I mean, there was a point where the character that he played over and over in these films, the names might have changed, but it was always Cary Grant, and he sort of just became that character. The one other thing that I always found funny that she mentioned to me once is that this was one of Hitchcock's maybe most expensive films.
Right.
Cary Grant, from what I did a little research, he was paid $450,000, which in 1958 or 9 was pretty good money, and plus a percentage of the profits. And he was supposed to get $5,000 extra a week if they went over, his schedule, and they did right from the get go. And and people would walk up to Cary Grant, and he would ask for his autograph, and he would charge them 25 cents. And she thought he was giving this to charity, but he wasn't. He was just putting the money in his pocket. He was a very nice, elegant guy, but he could always use another quarter, I guess.
Interesting. Oh, yeah. That's interesting. It's funny that this film ran so far over budget, because I thought that's what Hitchcock was famous for, was ruthlessly shooting these things on schedule. Because, I mean, he famously said that the shooting of the movie was the boring part. It was all
right.
To him, the creativity was before they ever shot a single frame, which was all the storyboarding and all the, you know, the figuring out of how to tell the story. And then the actual getting the actors just to say the damn lines was, to him, that was the stuff that was pretty boring.
That's true. And I don't know why it went over budget. I don't know if because they were on so many different locations and they're traveling around, and the different sequences might have been a lot, but she did say that, and I heard her on a talk once with Martin Landau, and they said that the movie was storyboarded before they even got there, and they knew, you know, he just shot exactly what he needed. If it wasn't going to be in the film, that was it. He just did the certain angles, and everything was done. Doing the actual movie, the filming was sort of like going through the paces with him. The fun of the movie was, like you said, thinking it all out and drawing it all down.
Do you happen to know, was he one of those guys that kind of cut in camera?
Yeah, you know, I did see her say that once, that he almost, he didn't look in the camera much.
Right.
I mean, it was the storyboard. And so he did, there it was. It was as it was when they signed on to do the movie.
Right.
He didn't expect many people to. He didn't really want anyone's input. You know, I want to say it this way, or I want to do it that way.
Right.
In fact, she said that he only gave her three directions in the film, and
wow.
She said this several times, that lower your voice, don't use your hands, and always look directly into Cary Grant's eyes. And that was it. And he didn't really, you know, you come up with the backstory. You come up with, you know, whatever you need to do it, but that's all I'm going to tell you, and that's all he did.
That's interesting. Now, I should explain to anybody who is listening, maybe doesn't know what that means. The cut in camera thing is something I heard that John Ford used to do, was that he kind of learned this over time, was that he used to shoot a lot of extra material, and then all that stuff would get sent back to the studio, and then somebody at the studio would then start making arbitrary decisions about how the film should be cut. And Ford didn't like that, so Ford apparently got so good at only shooting what he knew he wanted, he would literally not print any extra film than what he wanted. And so when all this footage was sent back to the studio, there was no way to cut it in any other way other than what Ford wanted. And of course, you know, you got to be really good to do that.
Oh, sure.
But John Ford was.
Yeah, and Hitchcock had complete control over the movie. The studio originally wanted the dancer Sid Charisse for the Eva Marie Saint role, and Cary Grant originally wanted Sophia Loren who he had had a relationship with at the time. And they were afraid that the movie was running too long, and they sort of demanded that some scenes be cut. And it was in his contract. No, this is my movie. You have to do it my way. And the scene that they wanted cut was the one towards the end, after the shooting at the cafeteria, when Eve and Roger meet in sort of the woods, and they sort of talk a little bit about the plot. And I guess you could cut that scene, but you sort of missed a little bit of the relationship there. But Hitchcock had total control over every aspect of the film.
Yeah, well, you say can't argue with the results, really. So after the whole scene in the train thing where they clearly do sleep together, Eve Kendall, which is Eva Marie Saint, she tells Thornhill that she's arranged a meeting with the real Kaplan at an isolated bus stop, and it's that Thornhill takes this bus out in the middle of nowhere, and it is this scene that leads to one of the most famous scenes in all of cinema, which is the crop duster scene, where he's chased by the crop duster. Now, do you have any insight as to why this scene is so famous? I mean, it's in every documentary about Hollywood, this scene is going to show up.
Well, you know, this is not original to me. I'm sure you probably already know this, but it puts everything about horror and suspense right on its head. Most, you know, thrillers or suspense movies, they want to make you scared, you're in a dark room, it might be claustrophobic, something could jump out at you, you don't know what's going on. But, you know, this shows that you're not safe anywhere. You could be standing in the middle of nowhere, 360 degrees, and there's nothing around you on a bright, sunny day, and, you know, right out of the blue, you're in danger, and there's nothing you can do about it. And if you think about it, the scene is ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense, because why not just kill him on the train? We'll throw him off the train. Why send him in the middle of nowhere and get a crop duster? And but you just go along with it. It's just fun, and I think that really is one of the top 5-6 scenes ever in movie history. You can't. Everybody knows it. Even if you haven't seen the movie, you've seen that clip of him running from that plane.
Yeah, they parodied it on The Simpsons once, even, where there was an episode where we found out that Marge is desperately afraid to fly, and then we see why. And there's a scene of her as a child with her and her mother in a cornfield, and there's this crop duster chases them, and you're like, well, that seems like a pretty good reason why Marge is afraid to fly. She's attacked by a crop duster when she was a child.
You know, there's actually, I haven't seen it, but you can find it on YouTube. In Australia, there's actually a live theatrical version of North by Northwest. And they do the movie, but on stage, and they do the crop dusting sequence, and it's a guy running with a projection on the street. But I mean, it's just this iconic image that I think that you're not safe, that terror. And I think originally that Hitchcock was thinking of before it became a crop duster, that he had thrown out why not a tornado? That he comes there and a tornado comes down and gets him, and then the screenwriter said, well, how the hell do they manufacture that? And so that's how it became the crop duster. And the other thing about that is it's this long scene. It's probably 6-7 minutes long, and it's very quiet. There's no music, and he's just standing there, and you watch one car go by, you watch another car go by, and like you were saying before, the man gets off the bus or is waiting for the bus. And he looks ominous, and it's just a guy.
Yeah.
And so, but you know something's going to happen, but where? Where is it going to come from? And, you know, you do see that crop duster right at the beginning, and you don't think anything of it until the man points it out as he's driving away on the bus.
Right, because he says, hey, there's no crops. What are they dusting?
Right.
There's no crops there. And, of course, to the average person, you wouldn't even think of that. You know, you don't even notice that, of course. So, yeah, isn't it amazing that Hitchcock managed to have two films in a row that feature two of the most iconic scenes in all of cinema? I mean, what other director could say that they even have two scenes on a list like that, and let alone in consecutive films?
Yeah, and you know, and the shower scene is the exact opposite. You are in a claustrophobic space, and it comes at you so quickly. I don't think that's 2 minutes long. I mean, it's there. She's in the shower, and it's over before you know it. And he really was, you know, he was the master. He knew what he was doing, obviously.
Yeah. So anyway, after he escapes after Thornhill escapes the crop duster scene, he ends back to Kaplan's hotel in Chicago, where he meets up again with Eve. He finds out that what's going on with her, and then this is when he runs into he gets arrested, where he goes to a the scene in the the auction house.
Right.
And he wants to get arrested there, so he acts like a crazy person where he starts offering money, and he says, like, he bids $2,100 for something, and then he lowers it to $1,500 and then shoots back up. And he gets arrested, and he's put in the care of the FBI chief, which is the guy named Professor Pupa, the old-timey actor Leo G. Carroll. And we find out that this Kaplan person that he's been mistaken for doesn't even exist at all. This is a total fake, because they're trying to draw out the real spy, which they say is Phil Van Damme. And it's Eve Kendall is in on all this. And it's at this point, I've seen this movie, I don't know, probably four or five times. It's at this point I really started losing the thread of this plot.
That's exactly it, because the famous Hitchcock MacGuffin, it's the plot device. It doesn't really matter why he's on the run or what the spies want or what she's doing. It's not until the end we find out, you know, why he was at that, everybody was at that auction and why they wanted a little statue. When he asks him, like, sort of, what's all this about? What's going on? And he says, well, you know, what's the government's involvement in this? And he says, well, you know, spies, government secrets, perhaps. And then as he's about to explain what's happening, the engine roars, and it all drowns out what they're saying. So it doesn't matter. Just go along with it and have fun and don't worry about it. It's sort of like, you know, does it really matter what Indiana Jones is chasing after in any particular episode or any film? It's just there to get everybody running.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. So the whole thing ends up at the Mount Rushmore Visitor Center, where there is supposedly a shooting where Kendall shoots Kaplan. Of course, we find out later that the gun is loaded with blanks. This features a fairly famous movie blooper where a little kid in the background plugs his ears before the gun goes off. There's no way he could have known that it was going to happen.
That's
obviously,
right.
He'd sat through several takes, and he was ready to go, and somehow nobody notices it. You see the little kid plug his ears. So, yeah, Kaplan is supposedly shot. Of course, the whole thing is a fake. And it ends up with this chase literally on the face of Mount Rushmore, which is, you know, and the original title for this film was The Man in Lincoln's Nose, I believe, right? Now,
right.
What is your, as someone who teaches this to students, what is your idea behind Hitchcock's use of famous locations to present these sort of horrifying situations? Is it to make that even these sort of bland things are unsafe as well? I mean, because it's the Mount Rushmore is one of the sort of, you know, it's a family-friendly tourist location.
Right.
It's like the giant, you know, the largest ball of twine. And I guess there's a murder happening. Is that the idea behind it?
I think that's part of it, and everybody can imagine themselves being there. Well, you know, it's sort of like, you know, I've been to the Eiffel Tower. I've seen the Eiffel Tower, and you sort of think, well, what would happen if I jumped off of this, or if I climbed this, or, you know, it's mundane in a certain sense that it's this iconic thing, but it's there. I mean, it's just Mount Rushmore, and well, why not have somebody run across it? It just, you know, I think that he was just interested in having certain set pieces that once you saw them, you would never forget them. Like you were talking about Planet of the Apes and the Statue of Liberty not too long ago. It's just sort of one of those things that once you see it, you never forget it. You can go visit Mount Rushmore, and any time you see a documentary about it, they're always going to mention that. You know, it's been around for years and years, but it's just part of the culture now. I don't know why he was so interested in that, but in Saboteur, there's the scene where the villain and the hero are fighting and hanging off of the Statue of Liberty. What's interesting is that I did read that Hitchcock wanted to use the Mount Rushmore sequence to correct something that he had done in the earlier film. In the earlier film, the villain is the one hanging. And hanging for his life, and the hero is trying to save him, and he thought that afterwards, well, that was wrong, because the audience wouldn't be in as much suspense, and they wouldn't be as worried if the villain was going to fall rather than the hero. So maybe that's one of the reasons why he did it.
Interesting. The chase ends up on Mount Rushmore with Eve hanging off one of the cliff faces, and then it's Roger Thornhill trying to rescue her. And then this final scene features one of the most audacious cuts.
That's right.
In all of movies, because just at the point where you're wondering, You know, I mean, you know they're going to survive, obviously, but it's literally in the middle of her dangling for her life, and he reaches down and pulls her up, and then it's a smash cut to them back on the train as he's pulling her up onto the bunk, on the upper berth of the train, and it is such a purposeful, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like a complete abandonment of the suspense for gag that it's like you really. I think a lot of directors could not have gotten away with it, but Hitchcock can. You just laugh. No, you're like, wow, that took guts to do.
And, you know, you don't see James Mason being arrested.
No.
He's just sort of standing there, and he doesn't seem all that upset. And that famous scene, you know, where they go onto the bunk from the cliff, and then the train plunges into the tunnel. I did hear Eva Marie say she didn't realize, I guess, that was going to be the ending. And she was at the premiere, and she was sitting next to her husband, and she said, "That's a little Freudian, don't you think?" And, "Oh, you got it. And so Hitchcock knew exactly what he was doing. I mean, if you're a little kid, you may miss it, but everybody else gets exactly what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I the first time I saw this movie, I was maybe 10 or 11, and I obviously didn't get it. I just got it just this time, actually. I'm very slow developing. But, I mean, I felt, when you saw it, you're just like, boy, that's gutsy to end a 2-hour and 10-minute spy thriller with just this ridiculous gag. I mean, it's Hitchcock just elbowing you in the ribs, you know, just saying, yeah, this whole thing don't take any of this too terribly seriously, guys.
Just have fun with it. It's just, you know, if you get the joke, you get it. If not, you know, the end. It's already done. And go home.
And what in your mind makes Hitchcock so, I mean, since so many of his films don't seem to be terribly personal, this one,
right,
certainly, Psycho, I would say, is, but this one isn't. What makes him, other than the fact that the films are just really good, what makes him such a artiste? Because you don't see a lot, you feel like you don't see a lot of his personal vision in these films, I guess.
Well, I think maybe in certain ways you do. When I talk about this movie or Hitchcock in class, we always talk about the auteur theory and, you know, the director as artist, and, you know, that's sort of silly in a sense because everything is a collaboration on film. But he did play out, if you watch the films, he did play out certain themes, you know, the wrongly accused person, his attitude towards women. It became, you learned something about the man. He was just expressing himself in the thriller genre. And yes, you know, he might not be saying, well, bearing his soul out, but I think to a certain extent he is. And I think the other thing that why we're still drawn to Hitchcock, because the films are great, but he really was the first director, I think, that the average moviegoer knew. You know, ask the person back in the 40s or the 50s, who was William Wyler or you know, some of these other names, and they would know the name on the screen, but they couldn't spot him. And so going to see a Hitchcock, you just went to see the next Hitchcock movie. And he became a genre unto himself. And, you know, the fact that he was on TV in the 50s and that he popped up in all the movies and, you know, he had his own theme song. He was just so much a part of the culture. I was trying to think of the first time I became aware of him. And the best I can guess is there was an episode of The Flintstones where they have an Alfred Hitchcock-like character who moves in
next
door. And it's like Alvin Brickrock or something like that. And they expect him to be – accuse him of being a murderer. And, you know, a kid back in the 60s, a 5-year-old, 6-year-old probably would at least get that. So he is just a genre unto himself. You see a lot of people try to ape him every once in a while. There was a movie called Dead Again with Kenneth Branagh, which
right,
I really like.
Right. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
But they're just aping him. He was a total creature of film, you know, and he's one of a kind. He's one of a kind.
Hmm. What is your students' reaction to this movie? Because, I mean, they're so used to things. I mean, this movie is, you know, pretty leisurely paced by our standards. By our, I think in 1959, it was probably considered pretty action packed, but by our standards, this takes its time.
Well, you know, some students really get into it, and then some don't. When you're teaching a film class, I hate to say it, but it's hard to get students to watch things that are in black and white. It's hard to get students to watch things that are older than they are. So, you know, anything before 1995, they think is old. I think you have to sort of prepare them. You know, I don't know if a young person, you know, who's just going into the video store or on demand or wherever, TCM, watching it, you have to sort of sit down there and take your time and let it come to you. But I think that's a problem, that a lot of movies today are so fast paced and so many cuts and editing. I sound like an old fogey, but I think you have to sort of go to the movie and just let it happen.
Interesting. You know? Where does this fit in your Hitchcock canon?
I think it's up there. I mean, it's got to be in the top five. I mean, you know, Psycho is great, and I really like Notorious. I mean, if you want to see Cary Grant about 20 years earlier, or not 10, maybe 15 years earlier with Ingrid Bergman, I mean, you can't get better with that. And it's very similar. It's about spies and a compromised woman and a suave, elegant villain. It's up there. I don't know. How about you? I know you like Rear Window. I've heard you say you like Rear Window.
Yeah, that is my favorite. That is my favorite. This one is a little lower just because it doesn't delve into some of the stuff that I find. Like
right.
the Rear Window and Psycho, it doesn't go into those sort of the sort of recesses of the criminal mind the way Rope does even as well. This
right.
one is – everyone here is – you know, the stakes just never seem all that high. But I will say, visually, like, this thing is so gorgeous to look at. I mean, I am a sucker for any
right.
of, like, the wide vista films. I mean,
right.
there's a great downshot of the UN
yes.
In this movie,
yes.
which is just so beautiful. I mean, the damn thing looks like a space station. I mean,
it
the
does.
Way it's shot, it's just so beautiful. And Cary Grant is great, of course. I mean, as usual. And they said all the character actors, Leo G. Carroll and Martin Landau, who Martin Landau is kind of playing a gay guy
right.
here. They can't say that, obviously, but he's giving it those shadings. One of the goons that is always trailing Cary Grant is a guy that I was like, where do I see this guy? And I realized he's one of the dads in Space Children.
Oh, my God.
Horrible 50s movie, which they also did on Mystery Science Theater, so I recognize him. I mean, the cast is great. It's one face after the other, and I love James Mason.
He's
such a great villain. He's so kind of laid back and just sort of confident in his villainness, which I always enjoy watching.
And, you know, nobody talks like James Mason or Cary Grant. I mean, they're just classy. I don't care. You know, he's threatening your life, but oh my God. Well, okay, he's kind of classy. I'll go along with that for a while.
Yeah, and I also love the sort of view, of course, and all films will have this. I mean, eventually, films made nowadays will have this 30 years from now or 40 years from now, presuming that we're all still here. But like, you know, the view of what the world worked, how it worked in 1957.
Yeah.
Like, there's the scene where he goes and he hides. He escapes the train by pretending to be a porter.
Right.
And then he goes into the bathroom to shave, and there's guys in there in their undershirts shaving. And you're just
Wait,
that's not a thing anymore. Like,
no, that world doesn't exist.
That world,
you know, like now everybody has a phone, and,
yeah.
you know, they have the sequence where they have Eva Marie Saint and Martin Landau are in different phone booths.
Yeah.
You know, the world has just changed since then.
You
couldn't do that script anymore.
And when he tries to find Eve Kendall in the hotel room, he goes up to the desk clerk and he goes,
right.
she's on the fourth floor. What's her room number? And the guy goes, it's 463. And she's like, okay, here you go. Like, you couldn't do that nowadays. But everybody was just like, it's okay. Here you go. Here's her number. It's fine.
The one that gets a laugh every time I've shown it in class is when he's in court for the drunk driving charge, and his mother says, "Pay the $2, $2 for, you know, for almost going over the cliff and hitting a cop." And okay,
I love the gag too that the actress playing his mother is, I think, in real life like 3 years older than Cary Grant
right,
was.
Right. And you know, and you buy it. She doesn't look old enough to be his mother,
no.
but she's got the hat on, and okay, you'll buy it.
She's an old dowager. It's fine.
That's right.
It doesn't make any difference. Yeah, it really is Hitchcock. I mean, I do really enjoy this movie just because it is just Hitchcock just having a laugh. And we sort of teased this earlier in how this led to Psycho, and that this film was a giant success. I mean, it was a big hit, but it was very expensive by film standards of the time. As you mentioned, Cary Grant got a chunk of the back end. So this movie was already very expensive before they ever shot a single foot of film, because Cary Grant was expensive and the sets were expensive. And it was Hitchcock just felt like his films had gotten big.
Right.
Out of control. And or not out of control, but just he didn't like how big they got because he had been doing nothing but movie star movies. I mean, he did Jimmy Stewart movies and Cary Grant movies. And it was even though this was a big success, he decided I want to shoot something small, and that led to Psycho, which is
right.
amazing.
And I think what he had seen was that like someone like William Castle was making a lot of money on these low budget kind of crappy, cheapy horror thrillers with Vincent
right.
Price or whatever. And so he thought, well, I can do that. You know, I can't have the Cary Grant budget, but I can do it on a TV set, on a TV studio. And I mean, it's hard to believe that he went from North by Northwest to Psycho. I mean, you know,
yeah.
small, black and white, intimate, psychological. You know, he went 180 degrees.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is remarkable when you think that rarely does one great piece of art lean to another great piece,
right.
turn into another. But that's really what happened here. I mean, and you know, North by Northwest was, of course, influenced a bit by Vertigo because Vertigo was not a hit.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this was him being Hitchcock being a little more commercial, you know, just being
right.
like, okay, here's this. I'm like, okay, we're gonna veer off the deep, weird, psychological Freudian stuff that I, you know, immersed myself in Vertigo and do something a little frothier. I mean, I can't picture Hitchcock doing a James Bond film, but boy, this is pretty close.
Right. I think it is close. I mean, the people who were making James Bond in the early days, they must have, well, I'm sure they saw this, but I mean,
yeah.
that was the closest thing to, I think, what they were going for. You know, big set pieces, lots of excitement, lots of action, and don't worry about the plot. Just have fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. When you think we've never seen a James Bond movie on Mount Rushmore. And you
right.
have to think, because it's been done. It's been done.
Right,
what other movie
done.
Are you going to do? Everybody's seen it. You know, this is the big scene. So, yeah, this is it's for anyone who hasn't seen it, go see it. It's just a really fun time at the movies. I would love to see this on the big screen. I've never had the chance to. This, I imagine, on the big screen must be just beautiful, just so pleasurable to look at because it's built for seeing it that wide.
Right. You have to see it. It's certain movies, Lawrence of Arabia or whatever, you have to see them
yeah,
on the big screen
yeah.
if at all possible. And every once in a while, Turner Classics has brought it out
yep.
on the big screen. They've have their Hollywood Road to Hollywood or whatever they call it, and they've shown it a few times over the last few years on the big screen at various events.
It's funny you mentioned Lawrence of Arabia. That is on the short list of films that I just refuse to watch at home. I just refuse. I'm like, Lawrence of Arabia cannot be watched on my television. And so I keep
no.
hoping that TCM will do it, like you're talking about, or Cinemark, which has a whole thing. I wish they would do it because I'm just like, I'm holding out. A lot of other films I'm willing to sit and watch. But Lawrence
right.
of Arabia, every time it comes, every time I see it on Netflix, I'm like, I'm not watching it on
no,
Netflix.
No, you can't.
It's ridiculous. So before we wrap up here, I do need to thank Chuck in public for this because – Chuck, as we mentioned, as I said, is friends with Eva Marie Saint, and he was generous enough to get her to sign a North by Northwest poster to me, which I have. It is already one of my most beloved possessions. I have it framed, and it is up on my office wall because, as I've mentioned sometimes on the air, I'm sort of in the movie trailer business, as it were, and so I have a bunch of movie posters, and there it resides. It sits next to my Touch of Evil poster and next to my signed lobby card from The Time Machine, signed by Rod Taylor. So it is,
oh, wow.
It is a very, very cherished possession, and I need to thank you in person for it because
well, that's the clue to trick to anybody. If you want to get on the show, befriend an Oscar winner.
Pay
and
to play.
I should just mention, because I do not travel in the Oscar-winning circles all that much, but Eva Marie Saint is the most famous alumnus, or one of the more famous alums that we've had at Bowling Green. Tim Conway is one of our alums, and Bernie Casey, the blaxploitation football
sure,
star.
Sure,
and,
yeah.
She's very interested and active in what's going on campus, and I got to meet her a couple of years ago when she was doing research, or she was about to appear in the Superman Returns, and so I came up with a little information packet for her that somebody had contacted me, and lo and behold, she sent me a note, and you know, I don't belong in that group, so I've been lucky enough to meet her and her husband several times. Her husband is a great guy. His name is Jeff Hayden. They've been married 65 years.
Wow.
He directed every TV show you watched growing up, and Batman and the Hulk and Lassie and Leave It to Beaver. And they've been kind enough to include me. So I've gone to a couple of cruises on TCM and gone to the film festival a couple of times. I just have to mention this because this is not, you know, I've gotten to meet briefly Tippi Hedren and Ernest Borgnine. And I was at they had a sort of a cocktail party for Robert Osborne on TCM. And she, hey, would you like to go? Okay, I'd love to go. And I'm sitting at a party in the middle of the afternoon, and there's Robert Wagner and Jules St. John and Mitzi Gaynor and Tab Hunter and Alex Trebek and all these people. And I'm standing there, and there's Norman Lloyd from St. Elsewhere, and he was the guy hanging off the Statue
Saboteur,
of Liberty.
Yeah.
And he's 101 years old.
Yeah.
He's still working.
Yeah, he was in the Amy Schumer movie.
That's right.
Year.
And
yeah.
It's like, you know, I mean, they are – I don't belong. I feel like I should be like one of the waiters. I should not be anywhere close to these people. But they've been very nice to me. And it just think of your grandmother, but someone, you know, an older lady who is just the coolest person, and she knows everybody. You know, I mean, she could not be a more down-to-earth, interested person. And I know she's – I told her a little bit about your show when I asked her for the autograph. And she loves the fact that younger people are still coming to these movies and listening to them and, you know, watching them and enjoying them. And that's what she loves. She loves that people are still enjoying the work. So that she's a wonderful person.
You have absolutely no idea how thrilling it is to know that Eva Marie Saint is aware of my existence and my podcast. That is beyond. I mean, I wrote a note to her. Everybody knows
right.
Chuck asked if I want to write a note to her, and I wrote a little card to her, and I mentioned how much I enjoyed seeing her in Superman Returns. I think I was probably the only person in the theater that was like, oh, wow, Eva Marie Saint is in the Superman movie. But just the idea that Eva Marie Saint, this towering figure of cinema, knows who I am is that's more,
you know,
than I can really sort of process.
The weirdest, and again, and they know, they've known everybody. I was on the Turner Classic cruise with them last fall, and it's a Disney cruise. And I'm sitting next to her husband before she comes out to do her talk, and he tells me, "Well, you know, I'm probably the only person on this boat who knew Walt Disney." What? You know, and well, Walt Disney said this to me, and James Dean said that. Well, what? You know, it's, you know, and oh, I remember the time Walt Disney drew a picture of Mickey Mouse and gave it to my, what? You know, I mean, I'm like, oh, thank God I don't live any closer to your house. I would be trying to get in and get that Mickey.
Yeah,
but,
really. Where's the Oscar? Come on, tell me where the Oscar is.
That's right. But they're down to earth. You know, they're professional working people. And they continue to work, believe it or not, they're in their 90s now, but they continue to work.
That's
and they're always looking forward. That's the trick. Just keep going. You know, she likes to talk and go to these events and talk about the past, but it's always, well, I'm on to the next thing. And so that's a good piece of advice I've taken from her.
Good for her. And, you know, Chuck, I hope someday that I will get to go to one of these TCM festivals. Every year I kind of hope to go, and it just doesn't quite work out. But I hope to go one year, and that would be so amazing for us to get to hang out and get to meet in person. That would be so much fun.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that. Before we end up this, I just have to mention, if anybody gets an opportunity to go to the TCM festival, I've been to the last three of them. It's wonderful. I mean, they are there's so much to do. And you have to make a point. Well, you can't see everything.
Right.
You know, last year it was, well, here's Danny DeVito and Christopher Lloyd talking about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And at the same time, Alec Baldwin is interviewing Elliot Gould. And then, also at the same time, there's Rita Moreno in the lobby signing autographs. And you know, there's Shirley MacLaine and Maureen. I mean, it's if you are a film lover, you have to go. It's a wonderful experience. The best one last year was, we went to see a screening of Bambi, and there's this older man who's about 80, 81 years old, big hulking Marine, still in great shape. He was Bambi. You know, hey, oh my God. You know, I mean, so these people are out there, and it's just a film lover's paradise. I mean, I'm not paid by TCM, but if anybody gets a chance, go, because it's well worth it. You could do a lot worse over 3 days.
Yeah, that sounds terrific. So hopefully 2017, we'll see. I'll try to make my plans to go. So I think that's going to wrap it up here. Is there anything else you want to say about North by Northwest before we sign off?
No, I just think everybody should get a chance to go. If you haven't seen it, go see it. And if you've seen it, you know, go see it again.
Yeah, it's really a lot of fun. It really is a lot of fun. So I think that's going to do it. Chuck, thank you so much for everything. Thank you for your continued support of the show. I really enjoy reading your comments every episode that we do. And then you always find some fun YouTube video that connects up. It's like a, you know, your sort of professory lectury life there, because you've got you provide our podcast with footnotes.
Yes.
which is wonderful. I really enjoy them, and it was great to talk to you.
I just have to say again, you know, congratulations on what you and you all of you do on all these podcasts. I don't know how you do it, because you're on all the time with different topics, and
don't
I've
go
always
outside.
Learned but you guys have given me a lot of pleasure and a lot of time in the car when I'm listening. You know, I'm listening to you rather than the depressing news about Donald Trump. So thank you very much.
That's redundant
for everything.
Chuck. All news about Donald Trump is depressing.
That's right.
But let's go watch North by Northwest again. That'll be a lot more fun.
Right.
So again, thank you so much for doing the show. I really appreciate it. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. Of course, you can find the show over on our network site, fireandwaterpodcast.com, and follow the show on Twitter, which is at Film and Water Pod. So go check out North by Northwest. If they ever should play it on the big screen, go see it on the big screen, and I'm sure it'll be 1,000 times better, and you'll duck out of the way as the crop duster flies at you.
That's right.
Tries to shoot you. So thanks everybody for listening, and until next week, that's a wrap.
Mr. Sir,
but you are making a picture
here?
Yes.
Yes, I understand, yes.
Is it a picture that is going to be in the sort of a mystery or espionage area?
Yes, I believe so, with a little romance in there, yes.
Miss Kilgallen?
Is it being directed by Alfred Hitchcock?
By whom?
Alfred Hitchcock.
Alfred Hitchcock? Oh, yes. Is it being directed by Alfred Hitchcock?
Yes, you are so right.
Well, I think
Mr.
Dorothy
Randall,
has
you
it.
Disqualified yourself, Miss Francis.
Not only directed by Alfred Hitchcock, but co-starring Cary Grant. Is it the award winner, Eva Marie Saint?
It is that.